Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, February 23rd, 2017.
No matter what happens, no one, not even the government, can defeat a community so full of life, color, diversity, and most importantly, love.
Amen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And that's the voice of Gavin Grimm, emotional there. He's the transgender teen in Virginia and a federal court plaintiff who's been fighting for the right to use the school bathroom that corresponds to his gender identity. Those protesters gathered outside the White House because on Wednesday, the Trump administration rescinded an Obama-era guideline allowing transgender students to use the bathroom of their choosing in schools. Is this a federal case about the state's freedom to discriminate? What is going on here, and what's the legal collision at work? Jillian T. Weiss is the executive director of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. She joins me here in the studio. Jillian, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, there is a question of states' rights about various kinds of things. But then there's the 14th Amendment, which says, states schmates, you can't discriminate. How is this going to work here exactly, and what does this do about the challenges that already exist, Gavin Grimm being a plaintiff?
The reason that we have federal civil rights laws is because the states traditionally were not able or willing to put in place the protections that we needed as a country. That was particularly clear with regard to race discrimination, and that's why we have the 1964 Federal Civil Rights Act. It also included a prohibition on sex discrimination, which was rampant at the time. Mm-hmm. We don't want to go back to a time when states get to decide whether or not we have sex discrimination protections and to whom they apply.
Well, but let me just clarify then. Are you saying that the Trump administration is removing transgender individuals from the notion of being a protected class?
No, I don't say that, because there was two specific letters withdrawn by the recent letter from the Trump administration. And those specifically related to a guidance letter that included a compilation and a clarification of previous law. There's been a decade of case law stating that transgender people are protected from sex discrimination just like anyone else.
A lot of states have these laws on the books.
And states have those laws in the books, and that's fine as well. But we do have federal laws, and we do have a federal constitution that provides equal protection to everyone, including transgender people.
So what you're saying now, it seems, is that Trump has created a real just kind of firestorm of chaos, and that he's kind of compiling together all these rules and going, you know, it's states' rights. We're not really involved. Leave us alone about this. But in fact, that creates more legal problems than it solves.
Well, I don't think states' rights is a serious legal talking point. It's a political point that's mm-hmm. being made. I think this is part of a larger push to kind of push transgender people back a bit out of public spaces, as Laverne Cox recently said. If we can't exist in public spaces, this is an attempt to deny our right to exist in public. And I agree with that. The fact is that we need to have protections. There was an injunction put in place by a Texas court last year stopping that Title IX guidance from having effect. We at Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund are involved in that case because it also put a stop to certain Title VII protections by the government. And our case, which we have in conjunction with the Department of Justice on behalf of a professor at Southeastern Oklahoma State University who was discriminated against, was stopped by that Texas court. So it's not just one thing. This one thing that was done by the Trump administration doesn't have a major legal effect. There were other guidances that provide protection.
So nobody in any school is going to be affected. Nobody in any elementary school is going to be affected.
Not from a legal point of view,
right.
But this guidance collected a lot of information. We've got 14,000 school districts. We've got 50 million students in schools. Where do school administrators and parents and transgender students go to find how to address transgender needs? It was in that guidance document, and withdrawing was simply cruel.
Is this a partisan issue? Donna Milo joins us. She's a Republican business owner and transgender woman. She's active in Florida politics and ran for Congress in the City Commission in Miami. She joins me now. Donna, is this a partisan issue? And what do you make of what's happened and what Jillian has talked about?
I think that it's a somewhat partisan issue, or I think right now anything coming out of the Trump administration has turned into a partisan issue because, you know, there seems to be a lot of outrage pretty much with anything that's put out. And I think that, you know, it's evident. And I don't say this to attack media, but you know I think that the Obama administration got a lot of leeway from the media when it first started, and a lot of executive orders. I mean, one of the things that prompted me to run for Congress was I thought that you know the system as we knew it in the United States was being torn down because there was no bipartisanship. You know, there was the mention of elections have consequences. You know, questions were asked as, you know, how's your golf game? What enchants you about being president? I mean, there were things that were...
The issue of Obama and the Obama presidency and whether Hillary Clinton should be president, that's a different issue than whether this transgender issue is a partisan issue and if it affects you directly.
It does not affect me directly. Look, I transitioned when there was very little awareness. I transitioned when there was no support in the schools or there was no support in society in general. And, you know, we were able to, you know, I think that when they did this bathroom thing, they created a problem where either a small problem existed or no problem existed.
All right, let's get a response from Jillian on that. So you say that when the Obama administration put its orders out, they created a problem. That's Donna Milo's view. Jillian, what do you say?
I would say they were simply clarifying existing law. It's not anything new. They were just responding to requests from school administrators. What do we do? Please tell us.
And Jillian, I agree with that. Now, however, I don't think it's really the federal government's position to establish bathroom dictates in local societies. I really do think that the federal government, as a small government person, as a business owner, you know, I think that we have a greater problem in the country with businesses failing due to overregulation.
Right. But Donna, does that mean you want someone in Florida to interrogate you about what bathroom you should go in?
No, I really think that if you present how you present is the bathroom you use. There's no bathroom. There's no police in the bathroom inside your stall to know what stage of transition you're in. My fear, and I think it's the fear of a lot of people who are not aware of transgender issues and the protection of children, and it's something that isn't addressed. You know, I have a young daughter. You know, I would be offended if you have a guy, and we're talking specifically about schools, but it's not put out to the public that way. The public perceives that the federal government is dictating that all you have to do is walk in to a bathroom and say, I'm a girl. And you could be an old guy with a pervert with a trench coat, walk into the bathroom and say, I'm a girl, therefore I want to use this bathroom.
All right, Jillian, let's get a response there. This idea of predation is sort of at the background of what is presented as the anti-LGBT lifestyle. Do you believe this predation is what this rule is all about?
Of course not. There's absolutely no evidence to back up that idea. It is fear-mongering. It's a red herring. It's a bugaboo. Are people concerned about their children? Of course. I'm a parent. Anything that someone tells me might affect my child, immediately I'm going to be against it. But what we have to do is educate people so that they understand that vulnerable, young, transgender students, not adults, I mean, I'm an adult. I can deal with it. A young transgender student needs to have an understanding school administration. We have an attempted suicide rate amongst the transgender population that is enormous. Part of this has to do with the fact that we do not, as a society, understand and accommodate and address the needs of the young people that we are supposed to be protecting in our schools.
All right, Donna Milo, I don't want to get into a campaign speech about Barack Obama, but what is your message to the Trump administration when you see this order?
Yeah, my message is that, as Jillian's 100% correct, there are laws on the books that do offer these protections. I think the federal government does not need to be in the business of interpreting those laws. I do believe that transgender children that are under the care of a physician, that are under the care of their parents, and certainly there should be accommodations made for children, but it shouldn't be something that's presented to the general society as a broad base. Here you go. We're throwing this at you from the federal level. You know, we have a lot of issues that face not just transgendered society, but all of society. You know, we have a lot of problems. There's a lot of divisiveness in the country. There's a lot of vitriol on both sides. And I think that you know, we need to do more talking. The federal government needs to do more incentivizing rather than more dictating. And I think that you know, as long as there's more public awareness and there's more discourse about all of the subjects that are basically affecting the United States, I think we're going to be able to make headway. This is just a simple hiccup. We do need protections for all citizens, not just the transgender community, but all of the American community. And I just look forward for there to being a little bit more discourse and a little less vitriol hailed from both sides.
Donna Milo is a Republican business owner and transgender woman who ran for Congress and the City of Commission in Miami. She spoke to us from Pembroke Pines, Florida. Donna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We also spoke to Jillian T. Weiss, Executive Director of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. In another battle of the executive orders, the Trump administration rescinded Obama orders that stopped the Standing Rock tribal protest of the North Dakota Access Pipeline. It looks like we could expect a lot more of this kind of thing. Can protests successfully challenge actions of the Trump administration, or are the courts the only real option? And is it an either-or question?
Whatever happens today, the world is watching. Whatever is happening, please record. We understand that we stand not to cause trouble, not to be violent, but defend.
The voice of LaDonna Brave Bull Allard of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Was the world watching? The 2 p.m. evacuation deadline came and went with little action in Cannonball, North Dakota yesterday. A slow fizzle to what could very well mark the unceremonious end to the month-long saga of the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. The Trump administration reversed the order that these protesters celebrated as a victory just a few weeks ago. Jay Caspian Kang, a correspondent for Vice News Tonight and a writer-at-large for the New York Times Magazine, has visited the camp twice, at its height in early December and just this past week. The contrast made him think hard about the future of protests and what's called direct action.
I think that if you talk to the people who have been there since last April when the first teepees went up on the banks of the Missouri, I think that they would say that it was all because of direct action. That direct action is what ended up bringing lawyers out, right? That the direct action is what ended up inspiring NGOs and other organizations to work with them, and that all those together was what led to the first victory. Right now, I honestly don't know. I mean, it's very bleak out there. I think that most people have given up. There are a couple of reasons for it. The first, I think, is because everyone is focused on Trump administration. It's very difficult to have any sort of space, I think, if you're on the far left or if you're an activist, to focus on anything except the presidential administration. So something like Standing Rock seems almost tertiary, even though it isn't to the people who are there.
And yet the people there, when you were there early on, spoke about the very strong legal case that was represented here, because this relates to treaty rights that courts might be inclined to view favorably. That this is not exactly pulled out of the clouds here. This is real, written down law of the land stuff.
Yeah, and the legal fight so far has not been good for the tribes. They are starting to resort to, I would say, cases that are going to have a pretty tough chance being heard. And so I don't know. I think that one of the things that comes away with it, that if you talk to activists who are at Standing Rock right now or who are involved in the fight, they would say that what happened was that strategically we decided to move from direct action and from occupation to a legal fight. I would be a bit skeptical of that, to be completely honest, because I think that there was no reason why the two couldn't have happened at the same time. And I think that given the quality of some of the legal action and the chances that it actually has to work, that sort of explanation doesn't make sense, at least to me as a journalist.
What do people who are hanging out in the bleak Standing Rock of today believe is the direct action that should come next?
So the rosy narrative that would come out of it is something that would sound like this. They would say that there are other pipeline protests that are going on in Florida, Texas, all around the country, even at Keystone, and that people have spread out and that this is now a national movement. They would also say that there is now a legal language that has been created to fight these sorts of things on behalf of Native tribes. I think that that's a very positive and sort of optimistic projection of what has happened. For the people who are left at camp and even the people who are in the Standing Rock area who are like part of that tribe, I think that it feels a lot more like they've been defeated right now.
And they're not as united as we were led to believe in terms of all these national groups.
And when I was there in December, one of the things that was readily apparent to anyone who was there, I think, was that leadership had been completely split and that there was a lot of infighting amongst the groups there, because it's not just the Standing Rock Sioux. I mean, when you have 10,000 people there, you know, like some of them really were like people who might have been at Burning Man, although I think that was a little bit overreported how much of the camp was that. There are NGOs that are there. There are different tribes that are there. And, you know, I think around December when they, you know, I think they had all reached a fracturing point. And I think that more than anything is why, you know, you see 200 people there yesterday.
As a follow-on, and again, you know, we're talking about Standing Rock here, but, you know, we've seen all kinds of protests in the wake of various actions of the Trump administration. And the question for each one of these protests is, wow, that was significant in numbers on, you know, day X. But the question is, what do you do the next day? What do you do tomorrow? What's the follow-on to a successful protest that makes a really good, you know, sort of television picture for the news? Everyone seems to be having that same problem right now, figuring it out.
Yeah, I think that was sort of my takeaway from the Women's March, which was that I had never seen that many people at a protest before in my entire life, including the ones that I went to in Seoul, South Korea, which had like hundreds of thousands of people there and ended up like impeaching the president. There was no sort of clear message. And at the time, I was just like, well, maybe it doesn't matter that it doesn't have a clear message because the show of people is in itself enough. But I think what you found is that without that clear message, that some of that has already dissipated, and that that what has sort of sprung up in its place, at least in my opinion, is sort of this desire to have a broad liberal message of dissent to the Trump administration that is a little bit aimless at this point. And I think that it'll grow, and I think it'll get better. But right now, it just feels like everybody is trying to lump everything from Standing Rock to Black Lives Matter to the Women's March to the airport protest all under the same blanket. And I think that, you know, if protest is going to end up being effective in the way that you're talking about, the first thing that they have to do is separate those things out and, like, try and figure out which individual message they're going forward with. It's not Standing Rock that's aimless. It's not Ferguson that's aimless. It's sort of the theorizing by, like, either the media or by politicians that, like, this is, like, a huge united movement against Donald Trump. I think that's what's aimless right now.
Jay Caspian Kang is a correspondent for Vice News Tonight and a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine. Jay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What's the difference between an aimless dissent and a successful protest?
This is Lori. I'm calling from Halifax. And what makes a protest successful? I'd say that it's peaceful, that it has a central message, that it creates civil discourse, and that it's noted. It's democracy in action, and I am all for it.
Ann Houck, Naples, Texas. A successful protest has passion, preparation, communication, shared aims and goals, and cohesion. I would also add smiles. If you're angry and look it, you're more apt to act unwisely, which is detrimental to the cause.
Garfield, Florida. What makes a protest successful is what happens after it's all over. If the people channel the energy into action that's actually meaningful, like calls and letters to local politicians and running for office themselves. Provo, Utah, shutting highways, businesses, political offices down, creating enough of a hassle for people, particularly people in power, that they have to listen to protesters' demands. What do you say? How do you measure the success of protest? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us. We're at The Takeaway. Politicians insist on making questions of gender identity and sexual orientation moral questions about what is supposedly normal in our society. But scientists believe these questions may be better understood as a matter of public health, specifically mental health. If people feel tolerated, then the anxiety associated with being different is lessened. It's a theory, but Julia Rafman, a postdoctoral fellow at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in the Department of Epidemiology, is co-author of a study that shows a significant decline in suicide attempts in places that have passed laws legalizing same-sex marriage. Rafman says this could be a key to understanding why the suicide rate is so high for young adults and particularly for LGBT youth. Julie Rafman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what do you think is responsible for this decline in suicides in states where legalized same-sex marriage seems to have had this extraordinary impact?
So we didn't explicitly analyze mechanisms by which state same-sex marriage policies reduced adolescent suicide attempts, and there are a number of different possibilities. So one is simply that having equal rights changed how sexual minority adolescents felt about themselves, and then that led them to have reduced suicide attempts. Another possibility is that having equal rights changed how people treated LGBT adolescents. So it changed how parents and teachers and peers interacted with sexual minority adolescents. Yet another possibility is that it was the campaigns around state same-sex marriage policies that led to reduced adolescent suicide attempts. We can also tell a little bit more about the potential mechanism. So we looked at a variable for passing same-sex marriage policies 2 years in the future, and we found that that was not associated with adolescent suicide attempts. So that suggests that any social changes leading up to state same-sex marriage policies a couple of years out were not what was responsible for reducing adolescent suicide attempts. It looks like really something right around state same-sex marriage policies or the policies themselves is what was associated with reduced adolescent suicide attempts.
Well, I would theorize that a sense of openness and an ability to suddenly raise issues that might not have been raisable in families might have something to do with this, but I'm not an epidemiologist. In your case, this is the first time a social policy has been found to reduce suicide. I know there's been studies of availability of guns and availability of other means of suicide. Describe that data.
Yeah, so there is evidence that that means reduction, whether it's controlling guns availability in the household or whether it's controlling bridges or tall buildings and making those safe environments. It's been found that those measures reduce suicide attempts. And I think this is the first time that there's been an association demonstrated with a social policy. And that suggests a lot of potential areas for further research and also can change our understanding of what suicide attempts mean. I think here in particular, we can understand that potentially the large disparity that we see in suicide attempts among students who are heterosexual, who reported a 6% rate of attempting suicide in the past 12 months relative to gay, lesbian, and bisexual students who reported that 29% had attempted suicide in the past 12 months. I think that we can explain some of that disparity.
Scientists always want to do more studies as a result of something like this. But what social policy would you recommend to immediately take advantage of this data?
I personally hope to study the effects of other LGBT rights on health outcomes, including suicide attempts. So I think examples are laws like North Carolina's HB2, where Tennessee has a law explicitly permitting psychologists to turn away patients based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. And I'm interested in how those types of policies affect adolescent suicide attempts.
Julia Rafman, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Julia Rafman is a researcher in the Department of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Aiming for China.
We have a $500 billion deficit, trade deficit with China. We're going to turn it around, and we have the cards. Don't forget, we're like the piggy bank that's being robbed.
And hitting the hallowed halls of academia.
Anyone at a university, if they said they weren't concerned, then they're living in the wrong planet.
That's Willis Wong, the terrified-sounding associate provost of global programs at Boston University. Did you know that one of this country's biggest exports is higher education in the form of foreign students, particularly Chinese students who pay full tuition? Under an aggressive Trump trade policy, colleges and universities could feel the consequences most severely. Kirk Carapeza manages our partner WGBH's higher education desk in Boston. Kirk, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be here. Thanks, John.
So how does trade policy and higher ed go together here? The Trump administration has certainly terrified some of these higher ed executives.
These are the kind of conversations that happen behind closed doors. I think it's kind of an awkward subject. You know, these administrators want to show empathy towards international students, but, you know, they've really built their business model around international students. I spent some time at Boston University, where the largest percentage of foreign students are from China. About a third of all international students in the United States come from mainland China, and that's the case at BU. Over the past 10 years, they've increased the number of Chinese students by 800%. In 2006, they had 500 Chinese students. Today, they have nearly 4,000. So I think administrators at BU and elsewhere are concerned that, you know, when Trump sounds off about China stealing our jobs and, you know, sounds off about potential tariffs, that kind of rhetoric leads them to think that a trade war or some kind of trade skirmish is possible and could affect their business models. Essentially, you know, states have cut funding and middle class families have struggled to keep up and pay tuition at schools like BU. These universities have really done more one-stop shopping in China. It's one, because it's just really easy, but two, they've almost, you know, they've built their business model around this, so they've become almost addicted to full-paying international students.
Well, yeah, let's just say it right out loud. This is the kind of thing that parents who have kids of college age have been concerned about for years. Yeah, Chinese pay full ride, so they get an advantage at some of these colleges. And listen to Willis Wong talking about just exactly how disruptive this could be.
Whether it's we're talking about Chinese trade policy, we're talking about immigration, it's quite disruptive right now. We all don't know what to expect.
So should parents who are concerned about discrimination based on whether you can pay full ride or not suddenly become pro-Trump, you know, individuals and jump into this trade policy here?
Not so fast. I think there's this widespread perception out there, right, that middle-class families are being boxed out by Chinese and other international students, but that's simply not the case. The vast majority of foreign students, including Chinese students, pay full tuition, so they actually subsidize the cost for American students, and if there were fewer international students, tuition could go up for everyone.
Although that's a bad business model generally. And
yeah, it's not. And I mean, ultimately, these schools need to control their costs, right? They need to make college more affordable.
Right. And Elizabeth Economy, who's the director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, suggests that, you know, there's a reckoning that's coming.
If a real trade war did erupt and things became very, very contentious, Chinese students could become a target of the Chinese government.
So in other words, the Chinese government would say you can't go to America, right?
Yeah, well, not necessarily you can't go to America, but they could make it more difficult for those students to obtain student visas. And if there were a trade war skirmish with China and the Chinese government were to target Chinese students, universities like BU, Northeastern here in Boston, NYU in Columbia there in New York, University of Southern California and Arizona State out west, I mean, these schools could lose billions of dollars in lost tuition revenue.
Look for uncertainty, I think, is probably yes. the guide there. Kirk Carapeza, who manages our partner WGBH's higher education desk in Boston. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
I don't know, but lately it sure feels like the expansion of the universe has speeded up. I mean, something is up. There's a kind of anxiety, a frenetic pace to everything. But it probably has nothing to do with the new faster figure calculated for the rate at which the universe is expanding, that rate known as the Hubble constant. It's a big news story. A vastly new Hubble constant would just change about everything for cosmologists, anyway. Then yesterday, scientists reported on the discovery of 7 Earth-sized planets that appear to be good candidates for life beyond our planet. They are a bit of a challenge for Earthling Elon Musk. They're located 235 trillion miles from Earth. He may have a way of getting there. So far, we don't. Good news, bad news, disruptive news. Jason Kendall is an adjunct professor of astronomy at William Paterson University. He joins me now. Jason, welcome back.
It's good to be here again. Thank you.
So what's your favorite, the Hubble constant or the planets?
I don't know. It's a toss-up. I mean, I studied cosmology in college, but I've really been following the exoplanet world just with wonder and just seeing how things are going on.
All right, since you studied cosmology in college, let's start with the Hubble constant. How would it change all of physics to have a vastly faster expansion rate?
Well, it's not going to change all of physics. What it's going to do is it's actually forcing people to wonder if there is new physics that nobody else has seen yet before. The problem that's occurred is that there's two different ways that we measure it. And the first one that's been the one they've used is to actually measure local phenomena. Mm-hmm. And local means within a billion light years or so. So that's kind of, that's give or take local, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So but they're looking at the expansion rate due to things like brightening stars or supernovae or Cepheid variables in various places. And then if you compare the measurements you get for the expansion rate of the universe from that compared to what you derive from the cosmic microwave background, there's a discrepancy. Mm-hmm. And so those two numbers are starting to not jibe. And the debate among the community is that discrepancy real? And what do we mean by it?
And does it affect issues like dark matter, dark energy? It does.
So what it does is that it could, in theory, mean that there's not a dark energy, but rather a phantom energy, which is even more exotic. The idea of a dark energy is that it makes the universe expand and accelerate. And that's been known to occur. And that's not under debate here. What might occur is that there may be something that there's a new physics like this this extraordinarily accelerated expansion with phantom energy that could even rip atoms apart in the distant, distant future.
All right. So how did they find these exoplanets? That's the other big story. Seven of them?
Yeah.
And seven good candidates for life beyond our planet. Does that mean there's seven in a single system?
That's right. There's seven in this system. It's probably the biggest load of planets around a star. In fact, it's the largest load of Earth-sized planets around another star. So sometimes people go, what's an exoplanet? And maybe some of the listeners are like, exoplanet means a planet orbiting a star other than our sun. So these are planets that orbit a star that's really small and red and cool. So all the planets are huddled in really close, like the ending dying embers of a fire at the campfire way out in the Poconos or something. So they're huddled in close. All seven are closer to their star than Mercury is to our sun.
So that means they might be warm enough or just too hot?
Well, there's three of them that live in what we call the Goldilocks zone or the habitable zone. And that is, it's not too hot, not too cold. It's just right. For what? For liquid water to potentially be on the surface. The closest of them gets the same amount of light as, say, the Earth does of those three that are in the habitable zone. The one that's in the middle gets the same amount of light from its little star as, say, Mars does. And the one that's further out gets a little bit less. But yet their average temperature seems to be that they could have liquid water on the surface.
Now, is this a star that was maybe more like our star and has burned itself out, gone into the sort of red giant phase and is now past that phase?
Actually, no. Actually, stars – that's a good question, though. That's because our sun will eventually become a red giant, and it takes about 10 billion years for our sun to do that. So we're halfway there, middle life star.
Right.
But this star started small.
Started small.
And it'll stay small. So it has a lifespan of maybe a trillion years.
So it wasn't – it didn't go through a phase where everything would have been burned out in all the planets.
No. It's just – it's always been small. The planets have always been close, and they've always been Earth-sized. And so these Earth – but that's the amazing thing. They're all Earth-sized. And the other four that are in the system could potentially have water on their surfaces too, given atmospheric conditions on the surface. And maybe they're in like pockets and pools or something like that under rocks.
So this sounds like – I mean aside from these climate suspicions, this is a very stable system. I mean, for the last trillion years, nothing has happened?
Well, the universe is only 13.6 billion years.
Or whatever it is. A few billion years, nothing has happened.
Well, that's true. It probably hasn't. But they're really close to each other. And one of the reasons we know they're Earth-sized is because they're so close to each other that they gravitationally interact gently. And so the timing between the transits, because how they were discovered is that there's a gentle dip in the brightness of the star as the planets pass in front of it. And so the timing of those transits, like how long does it take between each transit, that varies just a little bit. And so you model that and you say, wait a second, these planets are pulling on each other because they're so close. They're so close that if you were standing on one of those planets, maybe in the habitable zone, you would actually see them in the sky. And you might be able to see geologic features like continents if they had them. So they would be bigger, and a few of them would be bigger than our moon is in our sky. So it would be a totally exotic place to go visit.
A great place to take pictures.
Yeah.
I mean, sunsets with planets. Wow.
It would be amazing.
Yeah, that's good. Did the Hubble telescope find these?
No, it was found actually by a Belgium group. We call it the TRAPPIST group. And what they were doing is they're simply trying to find planets around other stars. And so they're using...
Well, monks, they have a lot of free time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, Lambic Ale and everything, yeah. Right? But the what they did is they actually looked out. They were trying to find planets. They found three. And the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is an infrared space-based telescope, it was pointing at them and discovered four more.
Yeah, confirmed the result and gave us four more interesting things to contemplate. Jason Kendall, it's always great to talk to you.
Great to be here.
Jason Kendall is adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. Among the notable features of this year's Oscar nominations and upcoming awards is the presence and impact of short subject documentaries, which are finding an audience thanks to the ease of downloading and sharing of video, and because filmmakers are increasingly finding backing due to the increased demand for content. A decade ago, the story of Joe Feingold, for instance, would probably never have been made into an Oscar-nominated documentary short. The fact that it is nominated is why we return to this segment about a violin. Joe Feingold saw at a flea market in Frankfurt, Germany in 1947. Feingold had survived the Holocaust and just wanted to play again. Joe's violin was back in its dusty old case in his New York home when he heard this appeal on our sister classical music station WQXR. Then station manager Graham Parker asked people to donate their unused instruments as a way of opening opportunities for people to play who might never otherwise find the joy of playing music.
The WQXR instrument drive is on. We want to put 1,000 musical instruments into the hands of New York City students.
My name is Joseph Feingold. I live in New York City.
Joseph Feingold is our donor of the day.
Joe's in his 90s. He couldn't play anymore, but also listening to the radio on that day was independent filmmaker Kahani Cooperman, driving to work on 12th Avenue in Midtown. What she heard resulted in the making of the film Joe's Violin, now nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short.
Through WQXR, they put me in touch with Joe Feingold, who was open to meeting with me, and I knocked on his door, and I wanted to see what he was like and what the story actually was. And it was, you know, I walked out an hour later knowing that I had to follow this violin and I had to tell the story.
Well, here's the story of Joe Feingold telling Kahani where he got this violin in 1947.
My brother and I went to the flea market, who came across the violin. So we got the violin for a carton of cigarettes. I walked the streets and I played the violin. It reminded me of my young years before the war.
His early life with his family in Warsaw was full of music. His mom especially was incredibly influential in his life and in handing down this love of music. He was one of three sons that they all played the violin. They all sang together. And unfortunately, as history took control of things, the family was separated and some people survived and some didn't. So that sound, and it's a testament to just the power of music, just brought him back to when life was normal and beautiful. And, you know, he kept that violin with him for the next 70 years. So at age 91, you know, got on a bus and took it to Lincoln Center on that first day of the drive and handed it over.
People who really want to learn how to play the violin from someone who loved an instrument in his early days, we can help you with that.
Absolutely.
Right, at WQXR.
Absolutely.
We got that covered.
The instrument drive was, when we came up with the idea of doing this, I think what makes Joseph's story so special was just this was the exact idea we were going for, was this idea of passing a legacy from one person to the next, passing memories, passing stories, passing opportunities. And I think that's what Joseph's violin represents so perfectly.
We have very exciting news to share with you all today. There's a man named Joseph, and Joseph is a Holocaust survivor. His hope is that it'll bring a similar happiness and comfort to a young life. And we are choosing one student to play on it during their time here at Big League. And the student that we have chosen, she really shows a unique ability to show her emotion through her violin. So we are so excited to announce that the student that we have chosen is Brianna.
And so you meet Brianna.
Yes.
What's that like?
She's amazing. So Brianna Perez, at the time when we were filming and when she received a violin as a 12-year-old seventh grader, she goes to the Bronx Global Learning Institute for Girls. It's in the nation's poorest congressional district. The school is spectacular. And in addition to the academic curriculum, they believe in arts and education. And so every girl who attends from kindergarten on up learns string instruments, particularly the violin. That's how they start out. And it's every single day. And so Brianna had entered as a first grader, and it's by lottery. I mean, she literally won the lottery going to this school full of so many caring teachers and administrators, and it's just in a really special place. And so she had stood out to the teachers as someone who was especially passionate about the violin, and they thought that she might be someone who could appreciate the history. And as it turned out, she more than appreciated it. It's like she feels it.
Everyone has those days where it's like dark for them, but most people find their light, and my light is playing the violin.
So at this point, you're just like, this was magic.
I mean, just when they did the first meeting, when Joseph walked into the classroom to meet Brianna when she had the instrument, it was like there was not a dry eye in the house. It was a spectacular moment. This girl possesses something quite deep, and her love of music is quite profound.
As Graham just described, it was one of the most moving moments I've ever experienced. In terms of filmmaking and storytelling, I didn't know if they were going to connect or not. I hoped that they might. And the remarkable thing is when Brianna invites him to the school and he accepts her invitation and he goes and they have this afternoon together, the connection was profound and deep, and you see that it's not just him giving her something, she's giving him something as well, and it's incredibly touching.
Dear Mr. Feingold, thank you very much for donating your special violin. The first time I played on your violin, I loved the immense and gorgeous sharp sound. Was also speechless when Miss Coco called my name. Music has made a huge impact on my life. I would love to invite you to BGLID so I can meet you. I am thankful every day that I have the opportunity to play on your beautiful violin.
If any of a million circumstances had changed between 1947 and today, this story would not be told.
I feel really grateful and so excited to share the story with so many people. There's no bells and whistles in this film. It's just kind of a pure story. This small act had great ramifications that affected a lot of different people, no one more so than this now 93-year-old man and this now 13-year-old girl who are forever connected through the power of music.
Connie Cooperman is director of the Oscar-nominated Joe's Violin, and Graham Parker is the former general manager of our sister station WQXR. Today would have been the 35th birthday of Nick Dupree, a severely disabled young man who died last week. That he lived as long as he did is an extraordinary accomplishment by itself, but as an activist, he changed the world for people with disabilities so severe they can't move or even breathe on their own. Because of his activism, He allowed himself and others like him to live at home and to receive government benefits at home. Happy birthday, Nick. We're sad to see you go. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening.